And we only have about 72 slides, so we should make it. I hope you enjoy these lessons. I have enjoyed preparing them. I've learned an awful lot. And we are in the section between, our focus really, we end up on 1939. There, so many things happened between 39 and 48 that's just going to take a little of its own time. And so I didn't get into some of the things I could have got into tonight, so because I already have enough material. So our big subject yet is, in these last two or three lessons, are on the revolts or the riots of the Arab under the British mandate. And that's our subject. But to get your mind back where it needs to be, we remind you that Zionism is born out of the renewed understanding of the Old Testament. The idea that you can understand the Old Testament without understanding Israel, I read that somewhere today, in fact, that if you don't understand Old Testament, don't take the Old Testament Israel literally, you can't understand the Old Testament. And that is true. So in other words, all of those books in the Old Testament are sort of locked out of your memory or your understanding if you don't allow Israel to have its rightful place. And that's why we're doing it, because Israel and the land are tied together. So if we study the land, then we obviously have to bump into Israel really quite often. And so Zionism actually started, first of all, as a Christian movement, not called that, but out of a renewed interest in the Old Testament prophecy that were not yet fulfilled. Then Zionism was born in the hearts of a few Jewish leaders seeking to establish a safe place for Jewish people who have suffered at the hands of the Gentile captives for nearly 2,000 years. So we have the Christian stream, we have the Jewish stream, and then we have the political stream that came out of England, which is also where the Christian stream came out of. Zionism was born in the minds of a few British political leaders who sought to help the Jewish diaspora, the scattered, and believed that the new Suez Canal, new then, was the linchpin of European economy. So they sort of flew under two flags. They flew under a political flag, but also these political people also had their idea on the Bible. So they determined that they would not cede this territory, this very important territory of geography, to France or Russia. Russia gets out of the picture, so France is left. So Britain wants to keep their foothold in the Suez Canal because it lets the traffic out to the East Indian or to India and the East, the Far East. Then we have the reordering of the hegemony of the nations occurred after World War I and with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, which ends the Gentile stream. Those are the three things we've been watching as we've been studying. Now, we believe that Zionism is the beginning of fulfillment of prophecy in Ezekiel 36 to 39. Remember that fulfillment occurs in a process that takes more years than we might have guessed. Somebody said we're already into this study is 100 years long. I mean, not the study, but the period is 100 years long. If we're going to pick a starting date for this Zionism, for the fulfillment process, my first choice would be the first Zionist conference in 1897. Now, there had been other efforts and other interests, but this conference was started in 1897, and it was successful. You wouldn't have known that at that time. It looked very shaky for many at some times, but it did survive. So that's why we go back to 1897 with Theodore Herzl. And the next shaping event then would have been the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottomans controlled the land, and as long as they were in the land, you couldn't do anything with the land. So the Ottomans had to be removed, which was World War I. Then the British mandate comes out of this breakup in the San Ramos International Conference that broke up the land and assigned certain aspects of it to, part we're interested in is the signed the aspect of it we call the Levant, where the land occurs, was given to form a homeland for the Jewish people, which was built on a letter written by Lord Balfour, written to Rothschild a year before, They picked up that language and incorporated it. So we have now the Jews tied into this land based on international law, international contract, a national agreement that was binding and still is binding. Okay, so then we have the British Mandate was born out of that San Remo's Conference in 1920. Israel claimed national status in 1948, making it the beginning of the dry bone state. So we have this prophecy that you might say it's kind of like a long breath rather than just a point like that. So when we read in the Bible, in Ezekiel 39, verse 25, therefore thus says the Lord God, he says, now I will restore the fortunes of Jacob. So that's where I'm thinking. You almost have to say, now. It's not just now. It's over a period of time. So this is perfectly all right. I'll restore the fortunes of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel. And I will be jealous for my holy name. They will forget their disgrace and all their treachery, which they have perpetrated against me, God says, when they live securely in their own land with no one to make them afraid. And I think that is the millennial kingdom. If they are brought into the land and they're secure, never to be afraid anymore. So in these two verses, we really have the summarization of the entire prophecy ending in living securely in the land as promised in the millennial kingdom. And we have two more verses that expand a little bit on these outline verses, which are the verses that follow. When I bring them back from the peoples, plural, from the peoples and gather them from the lands, plural, of their enemies, then I shall be sanctified, set apart in the minds of people, through them in the sight of many nations. So this is a testimony of God that when he deals with Israel, he brings them back from many nations, not from Babylon, which sometimes this is confused with. He's bringing them back from many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord God, their God, because I made them go into exile among the nations, again, S, nations, plural, and then gathered them again, I think the second time, because the first time was out of Babylon into Israel, but then we'll do it again, this time from the nations, to their own land, and I will leave none of them there any longer. In other words, there aren't going to be remnants left over for another regathering. It's a one-time event, and they all come back. I will not hide my face from them any longer, for I have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the Lord. And we know that when the spirit is poured out on the house of Israel, that they will believe in the Messiah as they should have done the first time. It would have saved them a lot of trouble. So those are the two verses, four verses we have at the end of Ezekiel 39 that really is saying what we're talking about. And I was born in 1937, so I've seen a lot of this happen, not as a child, I don't remember too much, but by the time I got to high school and on, and all of a sudden became very much aware of what was going on in the world. And then, of course, you get into your adult lifehood, and you read the Bible, and you have prophecy lessons and so forth, and it becomes more and more important, and in a sense, more and more clear. Now, this process, when the Lord says, now I will restore the fortunes of Jacob, we don't want to think of a straight line or a spot where it all happens. We've already said it's going to be over a period of time. Now, we've already observed for 100 years. And in some sense, you can say that God began to restore the fortunes of Israel back in the days when Henry VIII tied the Bibles to the pulpits, where the people started to read the Bible to find out about the Jews. So that had to be part of what God was doing to bring them into the land, because they had to get people prepared for it. Okay, so the Bible does not describe this as a straight line, so I drew a Krigley line up there, and that's probably less Krigley than it really is how God used Israel and how they seemed to go forward and backward and upwards and downwards and sideways, and their life was always seemingly on an edge of being destructed. So the Bible does not describe the back and forth motion of progress we have been tracing in the 20th century. In retrospect, the prophecy is still not completed. We would not have expected that the headwinds that make the restoration effort seem to be perpetually on the verge of failure. Always it seemed like this is not going to make it this time, not going to make it this time. Now, we have to admit, for the last number of years now, since the 1973 war, that's been quite a few years now, Israel's been pretty settled in the land. There's been threats and so forth, but there has been no outright frontal attack by foreign or five nations like they've had in the past. So they have tried other ways to settle Israel, and of course that always goes on. So we will continue to see Zionism on the cusp of failure until the very conversion of the people at the end of the tribulation. We must stay the course. We, believers, must stay the course, allow the development by God's timing, and we never get into date setting because it's dangerous and not very becoming of believers, because too many have tried that and been embarrassed. So we don't date set or try to predict too carefully the events ahead, although the Bible does give us an outline, which is what we're following. Now, in the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and the mandate to provide a homeland for the Jews were given to the British, one would expect smooth sailing. After all, we have the authority of the greatest worldwide empire in history. All of Britain was behind it. The sun never set on the British Empire. If anybody's going to do it, Britain can do it. And you know what? Britain wanted to do it because, remember, that Suez Canal was right in a spot where they didn't want anybody else to be. And furthermore, there were people in the government in Israel that really liked the Jews. They were believers. And so they were inclined to help them, wanted to help them. So this becomes something they wanted to do. No one put a gun to their head, forced them to do this. So in the 19th century, the land was virtually vacant. Add that to it now, and it had fallen into nearly uninhabitable space. The Jews have been a nuisance in all the nations, so they say. One would expect then that those nations would be glad to get rid of these Jews and let them have their own land. And for about 2 nanoseconds, that was true. Well, the Arabs and the Bedouin people did not see the Jews as a threat. This is probably true for about 10 years. In fact, many had good relationships with these others. I told you when we were in Cappadocia that in these caves that these people lived in and these valleys that the Jews lived, right, Christians lived right next to the Muslims, they all got along fine. So they saw these immigrants as a way out of their poverty. Wherever the Jews went, poverty, prosperity followed them. You know, the Arabs have no way to get out of poverty because of their lifestyle, because of the Islamic religion. It doesn't merit your best. You know, it's more or less getting along. Don't want to offend Allah. You know, after all, you might not do some. You might do something he wouldn't like. But when the Jews come in, all of a sudden there's some. You know, they don't make money, but the things they do, they grow crops, they milk cows, they make cheese, they grow strawberries. And people buy them, all of a sudden money starts flowing from Jerusalem, from Tel Aviv, and all of a sudden that money gets, you know, paid out to babysitters and sheep sitters or whatever you do with the money, and the indigenous population starts to benefit from it. And they saw that. Now, this imagined nationalism, you hear this still today, that the real issue here was that the Arabs wanted to have their own nation. That was called nationalism. And there was a lot of that coming out of World War I. You know, the nations were, lands were divided. And you have a lot of the nations, talk about British Empire, it fell apart because a lot of these nations wanted to be their own. A lot of those British territories in Africa became independent nations. India eventually became independent. So we have these ideas that everybody wanted to be wanted to have their own nation. And so I think the pontificators looked back at Palestine and said, those guys, that's what they want. They want their own nation. Well, that's imagined. No nationalism spirit existed in the Arabs or the Bedouin tribes, not from those people. They had lived as roamers and never showed any interest in land ownership, which would tie them down and starve their sheep and goats. We mention nationalism here because there was such a movement coming out of the oppressive Ottoman breakup, I just mentioned, but there never was a nationalism movement except in the hearts of a few leaders who were more interested in establishing a caliphate as seen in the Hussein family. In other words, this is something that the Arab likes. He likes to be the boss. And if I can get everybody under me, and I'm the boss of everybody, that's a caliphate. Now, the problem with that is you got to have people that do it on a voluntary basis. I mean, if you kill everybody who doesn't want to be with you, it wouldn't have anybody left. So you almost have to do it in a way that you actually attract attention. And one way to get these caliphates is get some land. And then you get the land, you get the people to go with it. So out of World War I, in the Ottoman Empire, was broken up, remember? And these Arabs lived in the Ottoman Empire under oppression. They thought that they should, this family, the Hussein family, who had two boys, Abdullah and Faisal, ought to be part of this big caliphate. Caliphate is just basically a Muslim power with one person at the top, kind of like a king. Well, they were interested in that, but that's not a nation. That's a caliphate. That's not a nation. But we hear all they wanted to have their own nation. Not really. Not in the grassroots. And those leaders that were there, they don't want to have a nation either. They want a caliphate. All right, just mention that. This imagined nationalism really doesn't exist. These are the father and the two sons. The father was Sharif at Mecca, and the next one over is Abdullah. He was the first king of Jordan. Remember, it was assassinated on the steps of in the Temple Mount in the 50s, 53, I think it was. And then we have our good friend Faisal. We saw him follow Allenby around, and he was boastful about what he had done and made stories, and Lawrence of Arabia helped him make stories, and Lawrence, and he probably had the contest who could tell the biggest story. But a lot of the stuff was believed in the West, and so he became a famous person. He was actually given the throne of Iraq, the new formed nation, and the French, remember, drove him out at the point of a bayonet. But Abdullah survived. He actually was the king of Jordan. He was assassinated, and then his sons, and now his grandson, is sitting on the throne in Jordan, and generally a fairly friendly country to Israel. But anyway, those guys are the ones that were interested in not nationalism, but a caliphate, and they wanted land. So they thought it was owed to them because they had helped Allenby in the war, and that was questionable. So they were just simply ambitious personalities, nothing new. Now, the bumpy road, in our study, we have begun, and will continue today, to review the riots that were staged in opposition to Zionism. Zionism, remember, is just simply the Jewish interest in the homeland. Zion is the name for Israel, or for Jerusalem, so it just becomes a name for a Jewish homeland. We might ask, where did the movement on an easy track with Britain, biggest nation, empire in the world, available, helpful towards Zion? Where did it get off the track? Where did it get derailed? And the answer is really quite simple, even though it is vexing. First of all, an effective crowd-stirring leader can derail anything. And we've seen him already. We'll see some more of him tonight. The second thing, there is tremendous opposition to God's works carried on by anti-Semites or anti-Judaism. It's really Semites. It's too broader a term. It's really against Jews. And then we have the failure of the mandated British to fulfill their desired responsibility towards the Jews. They wanted to do it. No one put the gun to their head. They volunteered. They were happy to have it. And they failed. So it's not anything that they could blame somebody else for. The real failure is there. And that's why I put the letters in big, nice, bold text. Anti-Semitism. It is unexplainable. The spiritual phenomenon that works in the metaphysical spiritual world with a demonic ply on the hearts of those bound to satanic ambition oppose every work of God. Doesn't matter what it is. This ambition is connected to passionate, untamed hatred for God's people, whether they are the chosen as Israel or the chosen as the redeemed. And they will not be requited. They cannot let it go. See Hitler's passion to destroy the Jews. He had a higher priority than winning the wars on the Western or the Eastern Front. His main objective in the war was to destroy the Jews. He never gave up on those. I thought, you know, I've watched quite a bit of World War II stuff, and you think we'd get along about, you know, a year before the war is over. They'd abandon the attack on the Jews and use all those resources to overrun Russia, but he has tremendous facilities assigned to destroying the Jews, and he does that till the very end. So this is something more than just normal hatred. This is supernatural hatred. So Britain is a tormented nation under the mandate. The Balfour Declaration was authored and approved by biblically oriented leaders in Britain and in the United States. I'm going to put President Woodrow Wilson in there. I don't think he was a believer, but he was certainly pro-Israel. But their two purposes, as I've mentioned, was Eastern Navigation Route and the Zionist Aspiration, those two things. Both were wonderfully complementary, so it seems. You could have both of them together. Pursuing the canal and was an easy sell, would also fortunately put the Jews in their own land. What a nice wedding this would be. While David Lloyd George may have put the Jews into their own land first, however, with the change of leadership, the equal purposes of Zionism and the canal easily moved to the top priority, and Zionist ambition just fell off the table. You just really can't do both. You got one or the other, and you start out with both, and the one that's the weakest or the least appropriate, you know, the right thing to do, sort of doesn't get done, but the canal stays. So this second look by the British, deciding now that maybe the canal is more important than the homeland for the Jews, it's easy to see that the mandate for the Jews becomes, in biblical terms, a heavy stone for all the people. Now, this is a description of Jerusalem as it will be in the tribulation, that Jerusalem becomes a heavy stone around the neck of the people. And we almost have that here, because if they could just get rid of the Jews, they could go on with the canal and, you know, everybody be happy. Later in the mid-30s, it was difficult for the British to commit arms to the Middle East. Now, on my board over here, you might see where I have Hitler. He came to power in 1933, and he went to war September 1, 1939, against Poland. And 39 is the period we're talking about. So all of a sudden, the British are trying to put out a minor war. Well, how minor is this war in the Middle East? And there's war raging, you know, with Hitler, and won't be long, he'll be bombing London. So Churchill's aware of the danger there is to Israel, Britain, so he doesn't have a lot of interest, or not him particularly, but Britain doesn't have a lot of interest in spreading out their army, and they have a whole worldwide empire that they got a police. I mean, their resources are thin. So later in the mid-30s, it was difficult for the British to commit arms to the Middle East. With the demands of a worldwide empire needing a military presence, and with the rise of Nazism and Hitler threatening another world war, the British have even less interest in defending the Jews against the immigration hordes of the Arabs who are coming in to the land, which are not recorded, and we have no record of them. But they came in like gangbusters because they knew where the money was. That's nothing new. That's so unreported, it's incredible. You always hear about how many Jews came in. Well, how many Arabs came in? Well, we really don't know. We know there weren't very many. Well, how do you know that? But somehow you get down to the end of it and you have a lot of Arabs in there. How did they come from? So they came in. But no one stopped them. All right, the mandate period finds the British facing two enemies. The expected enemy, or opposition from the Arab population, is seen as having an underdog status. I don't understand this about the Arabs. They're always the underdog. I mean, they're acted, treated like they can't do anything for themselves. And we'll do everything we can for them. This still goes on today. I don't understand that. It seems to be insulting if I was an Arab. Let me do my own thing. Oh, no, I need help. Like a bleeding heart. So they are looked at in the underdog status, needing protection from Jewish immigration. The Jews are coming in, they're taking our space. Help us, help us. You know, it's kind of that attitude. Well, what do you think? Well, it's a false premise, as I just said. There were many Arabs that were coming in. So this idea that the Jews are outnumbering the Arabs, wasn't necessarily an issue, especially in the first 10 years. There weren't that many people wanted to go to Israel. Why did they want to go there? Go to a desert and die? You know, with mosquitoes? I mean, there was not an attractive place. In fact, there were some years that Jewish immigration was less than the emigration. You know, they actually lost people in those first 10 years. So when you get to 1930, 1929, when the Arabs are saying, all these Jews are coming in and taking our jobs, it just wasn't true, which I'll give you in a minute here. When the Brits begin to favor the Arabs by allowing them armaments, which they never give Jews or seldom, and the Jews seldom attack Arabs, I won't say they never did, but that the Jews weren't the ones you had to worry about who's going to attack who. It was the Arabs attacking somebody else, either the Jews or the British. And then to deny the Jews these arms for their own defensive protection when Arabs attack the Jews. That's just one of those kind of things. Oh, how can you do that? In time, the British become the enemies of Zionism, yet the British did try to defend the Jews against the Arabs at a substantial cost to them, which we'll talk about that this evening. Now, the problem we have all along here, and the whole lesson, appeasement makes this increasingly difficult. You know, appeasement is really not a good word. I don't know where it fits well. You know, where you do something to please somebody else, to get something from him so he won't do that to you. Well, that usually doesn't work. I don't know where it works. It certainly didn't work here. So our judgment is that the British did not support the Jews when it was a relatively easy task, which would have been right away. A few Arabs, not a lot of immigration, decide that this is the land for the Jews, and we're going to defend them to the death that this is where they're going to be here. But rather than that, we're going to have to negotiate with Arabs, and maybe we'll, you know, and what did he do right away? Gave all of Jordan away to Hussein's son named Abdullah. You know, without a shot being fired, they gave up 75% of the land. Remember, that was from last week's lesson, or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. So with time, allowing rapid Arab immigration, no one counted them, including the Arab insurrectionists, and no one was watching those, they could easily form a growing opposition. The Arabs killed the Arab friends. You know, if you were a friend of a Jew, you were likely to be as dead as a Jew, because you can't break up the family pact. You know, we're going to do this together. And if you are out, you're an Arab, you're just likely to be shot as a Jew. So Arabs killed the Arab friends and the Jews. Or the moderate Arabs who were trying to form a relationship with the Jews. Those were killed. No wonder what you have left then is the militant ones. In the time of the 1936-39, that's towards the end of our lesson, rebellion, the British did strongly defend the Jews, but were so demoralized by the cost of it in their own personal British losses, they announced that they were ceding the oversight of the mandate to the United Nations, effective May 15, 1948. They gave up. Now I'm thinking, I don't know where I'll say it here, if I don't, should say it later, but what they were thinking a little bit was that when the UN was done with them, or done with the Jews, they were going to work out some kind of deal that by proximity or by history, somehow England was going to have their foot back in the door. And it didn't happen. But I think that's why they gave up on this, because they want to get rid of the Jewish problem, but want to continue the control over the Suez Canal and so on. A scorecard. You know, as the British defended the Jews against the Arab opposition, it was a good thing. I might give them A-, because there were a lot of British soldiers killed. The British also issued a white paper in 1939 that limited Jewish immigration to 75,000 in 5 years. That's 15,000 a year. That's not very many. And call for a Jewish homeland in an independent Palestinian state. So here's the Palestinian state. Inside of that, there's the Jewish homeland. But this will only be done if the Palestinians agree to it. This will be only done if the Palestinians agree to it. Do you think there's any chance that anybody's going to agree to this? All right. But that's what they suggested in the white paper. So in this 36-39 war, we have the British with 262 killed, Arab 5,000. I mean, they took heavy losses. British wounded 500, 15,000 Arabs. Jews killed 300, 4 executed. Arab 108 executed, 12,000 detained, and 5 exiled. So you see, the losses were great on the Arab side, and they weren't minimal on the other side either. That's a costly thing to do. So this vote on this white paper on May 23, 1939, 268 votes for the white paper, which would limit immigration and keep the Jews buying land, and 179 against it. I think it's a 40-60 split. The mandated land had Arab people. The mandated land had Arab people. They were living in the land. There were Arab people living in many lands surrounding the mandated territories, but only the British mandate provided a homeland for the Jews. In fact, the Jews were prohibited to live in Jordan. It was Jordan land. It was a mandated land and given to the Abdullah, that family, but the Jews couldn't live in it. Remember, it was their land to begin with. I mean, just things. Only the British Mandate provided for homeland for the Jews under national law of conquest. Okay, the indigenous people had two choices. Those Arabs that lived in the land that was going to be the Jews, it could have been all of Jordan, they could have stayed, they could have lived, they could have decided to leave. There was a choice. That's the way it is when you're conquered. You can leave. If you stay, you got to be put, you got to put up with it, and you got to put up with the minority. But there's a lot of people live under the minority vote. You know, depending on the last election win for you, if you voted the other way than it got to be, you're living in the, under the minority position. And I know you grumble, but you know you still live here. And you say, well, if you don't like it, leave, and that is the choice. So we don't know where else to go, so we stay. For example, so that principle that the loser doesn't get everything is something well established. That's why it's called the losers. And sometimes losses are great. And the Arabs had a great loss, but they lost. The war was won by the Allied powers. And the Ottoman Empire was broken up. Those people in the land had no rights. Just like Japan had no rights when the only one that survived the Japanese surrender was the Hirohito, wasn't it? The guy that was at the top, and that was kind of nice to be politically nice not to kill him. But the Japanese gave up unconditional surrender. In World War II, the Germans gave up unconditional surrender. But all of a sudden, in this surrender, which was really unconditional, now all of a sudden the Arabs that were there should have some say. And they wanted agreements that were made early with Britain to come alive and be enforced. They were null and void. San Remo's converts settled the issue. All right. So these Arabs, they had a choice to stay and be subject to the nation, which the Jews would have allowed. He said, no, they wouldn't have. They have. You go over there and you see a lot of Arab people, and they're Arab, they're citizens of Israel. Live with the people, vote, so on. All right. I just get disturbed by this two-way of dealing with things. Well, this 39 paper was really hard on the Jews, and we have, these are, by the way, all women, I think, in the protest there. They're protesting this white paper. The Jews were not part of the white paper. In other words, I may be confused here. The white paper was issued by England, but they did consult the Arabs. In fact, I got a picture. I think it's the next one. Yeah, I have a picture of the Arabs meeting with the British, and the Arabs would not sit at the same table or be in the same room as the Jews. So what kind of deal are you going to get? I'd say, well, then Arab don't get a deal at all. I mean, you sit together, you don't sit together. So they were smart enough to manipulate the deal. So anyway, the Arabs kind of win this round. It's a big one. And here the Jewish women are out protesting this peacefully. In the background, you see the King David Hotel, which the Jews will later blow up because Britain becomes their enemy because they're not doing what they're supposed to do. All right, so some of you have been in the King David Hotel. It's now all built up all around it, so you don't recognize it. Okay, so ending the mandate provisions, we had this vote of 40% had to live with the vote of the 60%. The minority must always accept minority must always accept the majority as the British did. This is the common practice of all democracies. So we have a picture here of the British people, and we have none other than the famous Sir Neville Chamberlain, who was an appeaser of Hitler. And caused all kinds of trouble in World War II. So he's in here still doing the appeasing. It must be the Neville Chamberlain appeaser person. You know, or if you know anything about World War II, you always know about him. Peace in our time, peace in our time. He comes all, well, just a month later or so, we had the Germans attack Poland. All right. Now, a small war now or a big one later? Which one do you like? Well, they took a big one later. They should have taken the small one now. It seemed like this rule and international law of who owns the land does not apply to rioting people. I've always wondered, why does it not apply to rioting people? In our present consideration, the minority in the land ought to be quiet and submit as those who lose elections. But the loser, the Arabs, were appeased in the beginning and will be again and again in the end. So once you find out you can appease your whatever, leaders, do it again. It's kind of like blackmail. You do it once, I'll do it again. So, and they won't quit. You know, the only way you can quit, I guess, like I say, big war in the end or a little war now. A little war now would have been really quite easy. Now, a lesson that is not learned, appeasement made the end much more difficult for the British and put a bad mark on their performance as custodians of the mandate. Appeasement cost the Arabs thousands of lives. And by the way, they don't care. I got a whole paper on who cares for the Palestinians. You know who don't care for the Palestinians? The Arab people don't. They let them rot. And the Jews do more for the Palestinian people than the Arabs do. But you would never know that from the press. Appeasement cost the Arabs thousands of lives. These are lives that matter, if I can quote somebody these days. These lives matter, but not to the Arabs, because it was part of their building their caliphate. Or destroying the Jews, which is somewhat the same thing. The appeasement cost the Arabs thousands of lives, whereas many could have had a better life than they ever had known or will ever know. But the leadership doesn't care. So we kind of leave. We're going to come back to this at the end here, but I want to go back and make sure we cover some things that happened here that really are important. We have three riot areas, times. We have the one in Jerusalem, Jaffa. We dealt with that somewhat, but I'll touch on it again. We have the Jerusalem Hebron riot, which was really a bit quite big, but short. And then we had the territory-wide or almost nationwide riot in these 3 years, 1936 and 1939. Now remember, this is about two lessons ago. 1929, the Nebi Musa, the prophet Moses, or Jerusalem riot, was just a month, within the same month of the San Remo conference, which met on April 20. This was April 4. Britain did not protect the Jews in this encounter with the Arabs. They just were not prepared for it. And the Jews tried to protect themselves, and they were arrested for it, and some were thrown in jail, and then the belligerent ones were also thrown in jail, so both people sat in jail. So the British just did not have then the trust with the Arabs, which I thought, so what? I mean, they're, after all, the losers. The British did not have trust, did not have the trust to fulfill their duty with Arabs, which there really wasn't any. Only their duty to perform and assist the Jews was what they're supposed to do. That was the mandate said. They were supposed to take care of the people in the land, and they would be taken care of. And then we have also the future Mufti, Ami al-Husseini, is a riot leader and arrested along with the Jewish leaders. Now, the Jewish leaders were not perpetrators, but they were put in jail. And the Arabs that were the leader, and here we have him, was put in jail. So both of them sat in jail. Why? I mean, he said, like the guy that got shot, you put him in jail, and the guy that did the shooting gets put in jail. It's indecision. It's just appeasement is what it is. Ami, a riot leader, imprisoned by the British military. British military. Now we're going to move to the mandate period, which is our scene between 1920 and 1922. Was released by Herbert Samuel, a Jewish British guy, who came along to be the civil administrator. And so this Jabotinsky was one of the guys that was jailed along with Amani. Two leaders jailed. Now, this Amani gets appointed, I'm calling the mayor, the Mufti of Jerusalem. He gets appointed that. And look how this happens. Remember, he's the guy that's in jail. Was in jail. Both get pardoned, by the way. You know, sort of appease. I think I'll talk about that just to get a little bit out of order here. Elections have been held about the mayor of Jerusalem, the leader of Jerusalem. Elections had been held. And of the four candidates running for the office of Mufti, al-Husseini received the least number of votes. The first three being, and the name there of the family candidates. Nevertheless, Samuel was anxious to keep the balance of power between al-Husseini's and this other clan. And so he appoints him. Look, the appointment of a friendly gesture to what was regarded as a minor post in an unimportant British protectorate turned into one of the most tragic, decisive errors of the century. In other words, this Amani is put into the position of the most powerful Muslim leader in the Middle East, and he was in jail, and now he's got this power. And the British did it. The British did. So how in the world you put the criminal in charge of things? You think, well, he'll change, I guess. I guess he must have changed in jail. So this Amin al-Husseini, the guy on the right, two panels on the right, is appointed. We've got these other guys who were mayors of Jerusalem. Don't worry about that. But this is it, that succession. And he served as this. Then they formed another Supreme Muslim Council, and this guy gets himself into that position. So in other words, the entire Muslim opposition is in his hands and will stay in his hands even after he is exiled, that's the right word, exiled from after having done something. But he still is in charge. So I talked before about the people were happy, they were not giving trouble until a leader comes along. Well, here's your leader. Here is the leader. It is not clear whether the Jewish-Arab agreement to work together in Palestine would have been feasible under sensible Arab leadership, but it became absolutely impossible once Hajj Amini al-Husseini became Grand Mufti. Samuel compounded his initial misjudgment by promoting the formation of the Supreme Muslim Council, which the Mufti and his associate promptly captured and turned into a tyrannical instrument of terror. Now we've got organization. Now we have an organizer of terror. Amin was a soft-spoken killer and organizer of killers. The great majority of the victims were fellow Arabs, as I mentioned before. His prime purpose was to silence moderation in the Arab Palestine, and he succeeded completely. He became Britain's outstanding opponent in the Middle East, and in due course, he made common cause with the Nazis, strongly supporting Hitler's final solution. But the principal victims of his unbalanced personality were the ordinary people of the Arab Palestine. As the historian Eli Kudori has well observed, it was the Husseinis who directed the political strategy of the Palestinians until 1947, and they led them to utter ruin. Now, the somber achievement of the Grand Mufti was to open a chasm between the Jewish and Arab leadership, which has never been bridged. Remember that at the San Ramos Conference in 1920, a year before he acquired his authority, the British Mandate and the British Balfour had been officially confirmed as part of the Versailles Agreement, and the Arab and the Jewish delegates shared a table together at the Royal Hotel to celebrate the event. There was camaraderie there, and then he comes along and just blows it up. It seemed like that's his legacy. In February 1939, with the Tripartite, which forms the white paper out of England, conference met in England to try to resolve the Arab-Jewish differences. The Arabs refused to sit with the Jews under any circumstances. This was the Mufti's doing, and in the long run, it was the failure to negotiate directly with the Jews, forcing them into unilateral action, which lost the Arabs Palestine. Now, I won't say that because that's a secular writer saying that. I see there's some bigger force behind, so I may not say that the Palestinians lost a country that was never to be their own, since it was given to the Jews in the Balfour Declaration. However, the Arabs did lose the legitimacy to even live in the land since they first abandoned it and never cooperated to accept the Jewish hospitality offered them. So maybe they wouldn't ever get the land, but they could have lived in it and had a great life. People, the Arabs that live there now today have a great life. They live in just as big houses as the Hebrews do. Well, from 1920-1930, that period, for 8 years, that land had rest. Since the riot of 1921, the Jews have been peacefully building the country. Arab villages were made money selling vegetables and fruit to Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. Arab landlords were made money by selling land to Jews or became rich in equity by raising land values through Jewish enterprise. Arab used electricity brought in by the Jew Rothenburg. The Hadash hospitals were open to the Arabs as well as the Jews, and there was a fair prospect that early and natural suspicions of the Arabs born on vague fear and ignorance of the character of the newcomers would gradually be eliminated. We got a period of time that looks like it's going to work. Samuel says, the day when Palestinianism as a nationality will emerge, he says, into existence, we'll be happy, one for the Jews and the Arabs. They will not be at the mercy of chance, currents of passion, and the men who trade on them. And that's what Amin has done. He's traded on these men for his benefit. For years, a number of city Arabs tried to rouse a political resentment against the building of Jewish homeland. they did not succeed because their Arabo-Palestinian nationalism, which they banked on, did not exist. So now what are we going to do? Change tactics. The second violent riot, this one in 29. The superior success of the 1929 riots was due to a switch of tactics. Unable to awaken the political revolt, Arab agitators turned to religious possibilities. We see this today. This is where it started. They found out what works. There was another Arab program in 1929 in which 150 Jews were killed. British response, as before, was to tighten immigration. Remember, some of those boats came in the harbor, and they turned them back in the harbor. The Labor Colonial Secretary, Passfield, was unsympathetic. His white paper was 1930, not 1939, the earlier one, was the first unmistakable sign of anti-Semitism in the British state paper. The British Prime Minister, Macdonald, thanks to him, immigration was resumed. Now, there were hundreds of thousands of increasingly frightened Jews trying to get in, but with each wave of Jewish immigration, the wave of Arab reaction became more violent. So we're getting to the end of that 10-year period. Samuel says, and he wrote a book called It Happened in Jerusalem, wrote in 1939, Eyewitness to These Events. I bought it at our book sale here, one of those books that you just love to find. He says, on the new year, 1929, the Jews brought into the Wailing Wall place a portable linen screen, a portable wooden frame to divide off the male and female worshipers. If some of you have been there, you know that the women are divided from the men. Division of sexes during the worship is one of the features of Orthodox services, but is irregularly observed in the Wailing Wall place since there was no structure on the ground. I mean, there was no permanent structure. Now we have Keith Roach, that's a hyphenated name, governor of Jerusalem, deputy district commissioner of Jerusalem for the British. It seems to have been an incident of the most trivial significance to anyone, but a Jew. Yet the quick cunning of a few Arabs and the curious behavior of at least one high British official created a situation. There should be no questioning the Jews, their right to place an object to facilitate the religious activity, I say. Rather, they were told they should not have done it. The British are telling the Jews they shouldn't do that. Suddenly, the business of the building of the Jewish homeland seemed to center on this problem of whether or not the Jews could introduce a portable screen into the Wailing Wall place. The Arabs' pretense was that the Jews were attempting to alter their Arab holy place by erecting a screen. Remember now, religious things matter more than political things. That's the thing they found out works. Now, do they care? No, it just works. So we have the Wailing Wall. Some of you have been there. You know, the platform's way up high. The Wailing Wall is down low. The Wailing Wall is with one side low, the other side filled up. On top of the wall level, ground begins. It is the temple area of the Muslim. But not until recently, the lower section had no special significance. So in front of the Wailing Wall, there is a small oblong space. I try to show that with my little line. Here, for many, many centuries, Jews have congregated for prayer. To the Jewish mind, it is unquestionably the most sacred spot in the world. This little sack is a cul-de-sac or a blind alley. One side of the Wailing Wall and the three sides are the lower walls of the Arab houses. Okay, wall and houses. At one corner is a narrow little street passing through Arab property, enters the place of the Wailing Wall through a door. In July 1929, and the riots were in August of 29, in July 29, the Arab altered the cul-de-sac and made it a thoroughfare by adding a door at the far end. Do you see the door at the far end? You cannot see the door at the far end. It's right there. Okay, now I'll go back and you can probably see it better. Yeah, it's here. I think I have another one. I'll show it again. All right, so they added that door. They entered the door. It enters private property and allows people to pass through the prayer site, making disturbances for the Jews who are not even allowed a table or a chair. The British commissioner, our last guy, the hyphenated man guy, the British commissioner took the side of the Arabs and said the door will be closed during services. Well, if you've ever been to the Wailing Wall, there are never any time when there aren't services. They're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Oh, well. So we have the, see the door here better now? Here, and it's here. Okay, that's the same thing. Now, these are arches here, so it's quite a bit different. But anyway, that's the picture of it. All this protest by the Arab is particularly maddening in the dishonesty of a sudden Arab discovery that the top of the Wailing Wall was sacred to the memory of Muhammad's horse, Al-Burak, and that they had ignored it for centuries, but gave them a superior claim to that of the Jews, to whom the place is sacred by virtue of its connection with the temple. So this horse tie-on place is much more important than the Jews and their temple. We're going to give them their temple spot, whether it's a right one or not. They think it is. All right. So it's maddening, he says. The worst massacres took place in Safed, which is by Galilee, Hebron, Jerusalem, and Matzah. In all, 133 Jews and 116 Arabs were killed in the riots. 339 Jews, 232 Arabs were injured. Most of the Arabs were killed by the British police and some of the Haganah in self-defense. Haganah is their military. From the Jewish side. There were also instances of Jewish atrocities. The Jews did their job. Jews broke into a mosque and destroyed the Quran. In Tel Aviv, Arabs killed four Haganah men, so the Haganah retaliated by raiding the Arab house and killing four people. You know how this goes on. Remember who started this. The massacres of 1929 thus had launched two themes that were to reoccur in history of Israel and Palestine. One, agitation related to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Remember when Sharon went up there, he now died, the guy had a stroke. He went up there to worship and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they revolted. He was up there to do something. And they were going to, this little pathway up to the Temple Mound that was a real rickety and looked like it was going to fall down. They rebuilt. And the Muslim had a fit because they thought they were going to destroy the Temple Mount. It's these religious things that they have in the back of their mind. And you get the Muslim worked up about the religious things, you've got trouble. So we have things that related to the Jewish or to the Arab Muslim faith. And then the other side is the separation from the Arabs by the Jews. You know, you can't live with them. So what do you do? You put a fence between you. And hence, we got the wall around Bethlehem and so on. So that continues. And then they're so put out because, well, that's the only way you can survive. Okay, the immediate consequences of the riots were that the British caved in to every demand of the Arabs, though only a small number of Jews had immigrated to Palestine under the mandate in that early decade. The British accepted at face value the claim that the Mufti, that these immigrants, and by the way, Ami already is in charge here, rather than the world economic oppression, remember 1929, worldwide, were the fault of the real and imagined woes of the Arabs in Palestine. In the year 1930, when unemployment reached 25% in some countries, Palestinian Arabs had an unemployment rate of 4%. And they blamed that on the Jews and the immigration. It looked like it was the opposite. Immigration was making them prosperous. Okay, now we come back to our 36-39 riot. That's our third one. The Arab main aim was to impel the British government to change policy established in 1917 by Lord Balfour. Now, they saw that other countries were renegotiating their deals, and they said, well, let's renegotiate ours too. That's what they thought. Okay. So they wanted to renegotiate the promise to facilitate the creation of a Palestinian, of a national home for the Jews, an undertaking that was confirmed by the League of Nations. So he wanted to undo that. Now, the stream of Jewish immigrants increased by 1936 to 400,000. That's a lot of people. The demographic growth and the sharp increase in economic, industrial, and agricultural activities proved that the Zionist dream of turning Palestine into a haven for masses of Jews was sustainable. One of the arguments was the land can't sustain it. Well, now, that's what Britain always said. That's why they limit immigration. Might I say, well, that's not a reason. Look at it, boom. The 3 years of continuous military struggle, 36-39, that ensued witnessed many ups and downs, current crisis, many casualties, and loss of property. Only at the end of that period did the British Army manage to quell the riot. It took 3 years. The winds of war were already blowing in Europe. Therefore, despite their military success, in order to avoid another front in the Middle East, the British decided to adopt the policy of appeasing the Arabs. Now, if you didn't think they did it before, they really do it now. The White Paper of May 1939, released in 1939, cast a heavy shadow on the future of the Jewish national home and made Great Britain its great enemy. In the early afternoon of April 15, 1936, a convoy of trucks, they shot two guys that started it. Next day, two Arabs were shot by some unknown person. Guess who? You know, so the things just started. The Peel Commission now tried to study this thing. Why can't these guys get along? Everybody's going to have a report from a committee, right? So they decided the most important part of this whole thing was that they need to have a country that is divided with Arabs, to Arab country and a Jewish country, divide the land, in other words. It was a revolutionary turn in British policy to suggest that this British land now is going to become Arab land. I said, again? All right, the revolutionary turn in British policy over Palestine, which so far had adhered to the development of a united high national state. Bi-national state, not high. Trying to rush through this. Okay, here at this point, because of there was a shooting of one of the British officers. In the bold text, the most decisive action about that was the dismissal of Amin al-Husseini, met him earlier, from his position at the head of the High Muslim Council, a position to which he was nominated by the British Council, Mr. Samuel, 1921. So they got rid of him. But, man, look at all the damage he's done in the meantime. And furthermore, he just goes away and continues it, you know, in absentia. Okay, on May 17, London published a white paper that contained the expected new policy declaration over Palestine. It pronounced Britain's undertaking to set up within 10 years an independent state of Palestine. No federal arrangement were mentioned. The proclamation, which was concluded after consultation with several Arab states held in Cairo, was designed to satisfy British interest in the imminently expected war of Europe. I mean, they're looking a way to get out of this, and they only consulted the Arabs. The strategic interest to avoid opening a second front in the Middle East was compelling. The white paper also imposed severe constraints on the Jews and their areas of immigration and land purchase. Those are the two bad things. It was a dramatic change in Great Britain's attitude towards the Zionist endeavor and brought about a crisis in the relationship with the Jewish people and the British government. I am hurrying a little bit. I didn't see the clock. Despite the military failures, the Arab revolt was a landmark in the history of the Palestinian national movement. The Palestinians dared to challenge the British rule in Palestine, managed to insert their cause on the empire's agenda to commit the Arab states to their side and make the United Kingdom withdraw its support of the Zionist program. They got it done, finally. Now here we sit. The Arab revolt had negative results. The revolt also had negative results for the Arab community in Palestine. The casualties and the heavy economic price they had to pay, the international bitterness, bitter rifts, and the removal of an entire layer of leaders that caused severe setbacks for the future development of their national movement. This is upon the secular perspective. Paradoxically, the Arabs' revolt gave an important incentive to the development of the Jewish homeland. You got this push and pull. It has a bad side, it has a good side. I just put the map up there to show you that in a three-month period, May, June, July, the places where all these little uprisings occurred, and you go back and it says how many were killed in each one of those places. I mean, this is an interesting book, if you have interest in that. I got a lot of books I'd like to show you. Here's one that shows you day by day what happened. The revolt spurred a leap forward in the Haganah's military organization and strategic doctrine, and provided a strong thrust to the development of the Jewish economic infrastructure of the country. In other words, something is going on under this pressure in the Jewish people. So as the British lose their influence or power, on the other side we see the strengthening of the Jews. And this is providential, because if there would have been revolt in that first bar, up here, the Jews wouldn't have had a chance. But you give them a couple of revolts where they've learned some things, learned some things, and they learn a lot here. So when it comes to 1947 and 1948, when they actually have to go to war against five nations, they have an idea how to do that. So anyway, it's providential, we could say. I would say. So let's summarize. Like another noble experiment, the mandate was flatly not a success. The epitaph was spoken by Winston Churchill when the White Paper 1939 concealed further Jewish immigration, canceled further Jewish immigration and land purchases, thus ending the hope of a national home. It ended it, they thought. This, he said, this is Churchill, this, he said, is a breach. This is a violation of the pledge. This is an abandonment of the Balfour Declaration. This is the end of the vision of hope of the dream. Churchill was very much in favor of a Jewish homeland. Yet the mandate served a purpose. If to the British it was a perpetual headache, that's an understatement, and because of the way they managed it, it wouldn't have been that hard. And to the Arabs, in a national insult if they chose to take it so. To the Jews, it was an opportunity, but almost not quite fatal. Remember, this is the piece of land they got to begin with. 75% of it was given away to the Arabs without even them asking for it, almost. And now when we're done, this is what's being suggested by the British. See the orange part? That's what they suggest for the British in their partitioning of the land. Now, that's, you don't recognize that because that's not what ended up being the partition by the UN. Can you imagine the small piece? I was going to figure out how many square miles that is. Now, remember how much we started with? I mean, let's go back here. Oops. That piece there. That's what we started with. Now we're down to that little piece. I mean, you know, it's almost like you see it over here. It's a little sliver in here. And this is what it was to begin with. I mean, it's incredible. So this, the Peel Commission comes up with this recommendation, which comes out of the 1939 rebellion, the riots. The Peel Commission planned for the smaller partition in 1938. 3,300,000 Jews with 188,000 Arabs. The notch is now a sliver. Palestine was never more than a small notch, Balfour said, in the vast expanse of Arab lands freed by the British arms after the last war. To the Arabs, it represented 1% of the total area which they were being given self-government by the British. 1%. To the Jews, it represented the only hope of ever recovering home, country, and statehood. The framers of the mandate recognized the relative equities or inequities involved, assumed under its terms a primary obligation towards the Jews. Obviously, that's what they were trying to do. But from the moment when the fatal fiction of a dual responsibility toward Arab and Jew alike was adopted, the mandate was unworkable. You can't be married to two spouses with not favoring one of them. And they favored the ugly one, I guess. I don't know. Nothing personal. Perhaps the fault was in the times. In another era, less dominated by what Edmund Burke once called the irresistible operation of feeble counsels. I like that. I think we're living under those now. The irresistible operation of feeble counsels, the mandate might have had a chance. I would say that's not a divine perspective. Indeed, it became a long effort for Britain to escape the consequences that conscience had committed her to. It came out of the conscience. And now to get rid of what was in your conscience is so hard. The original pledge, which she soon found was awkward to keep, this is Britain, she attempted thereafter to whittle away, to invalidate, and at last, desperately weary of the entanglement, to cancel. The final years were spent in an attempt to stay on in Palestine as mandatory after having repudiated the terms of the mandate. Until this position, too, became no longer tenable. Remember, you got to think, if Britain says, I'm going to give up on the mandate, you're giving up on the Suez Canal. I mean, you've got to think this is really serious business. And we have Leonard Emery, a former colonial secretary, says, "We decamp ignominiously amid carnage and confusion." For the Jews, these ignoble years were lived on the cusp of the volcano of annihilation. But they proved to be exactly what was needed to solidify, organize, and harden the Jewish generation to secure the land and their national identity. God did not put them in a hothouse environment to be coddled and indulged, but hammered out a generation that will be committed to take on the world if need be, or die in the effort if necessary. Here the nation is greater than the individual. We marvel again at the inscrutable wisdom of God, of Israel, who too is the God of our salvation. And I must add at this point, there is more to come. So now, as a last word, we take a break until January 6, 2016. Then we will discuss the period after the mandate breaks down, and the Jews realize that for all practical purposes, they are on their own. The Second World War started September 1, 1939, so the most severe Jewish persecution ever lies in the next eight-year period. Further frustrating the Jews in this time is the British restricted immigration policies and of nearly every other nation who will deny Jewish immigration. I'd say the pressure is on the Jews horribly in this next eight-year section. And the war ends in 1945. Britain cedes the mandated duties to the UN, who divided the land again. And the Jews accept the division, but the Arabs do not. So on May 16, 1948, war breaks out in the land, and the Jews are threatened as never before. And with that, we offer you a Merry Christmas. I mean, sometimes we lose track. You know, Jesus Christ was born in the stable, and that's connected to what we're talking about here. So, you know, we're talking more about the Arabs than about the Jews. But remember, that's the story here. It's what they're doing to the Jews. And that's the story. And, it's almost like, yeah, that's right. We are talking about the same thing. Well, it's in the land, isn't it? And, of course, out of this comes the prophetic future that God will bring his people back to land. I read that from Ezekiel 39. And so all these little pieces that have to be lived out day by day, moment by moment, death by death, birth by birth, you know, appeasement by appeasements. And we look at this and, you know, we wonder, is Israel going to ever survive this? And we look back and wonder, how did they survive it? And yet we say, they will survive. With guilty the other day, if you want to be safe, go to Israel. You know, because God's going to protect them. It doesn't mean they're not going to have difficulty, but no such promise for anywhere else in the world. But Israel, there is a promise that God will protect them. And someday, it says, we read that in Ezekiel, someday you'll live securely in your land and no one will make you afraid. All right, well, we can have that security right now as we trust the Lord for our salvation and our future. And let's pray and let you go. Lord, thank you for the evening together. Lord, for the opportunity we have to discuss this very, very fruitful time of the history. Lord, as it leads up to the very forming of Israel as a nation, that recognized by the nations of the world and brought them back into a condition where you will further deal with them as a witness to the world, because they are your people and the people will eventually understand that and will give honor to you for it. Thank you, Lord, for the gospel. Lord, we just remember the birth of Christ that we're remembering this month as we approach Christmas. Realize that there are so many things that interfere with that thought, but Lord, allow us to remember that he did come to die on the cross, and he had to do that by becoming born to the human race. And for that, we thank you. And for all of the privileges that we have because of our relationship with you, we thank you. The provision of this room and this place and the health that we have is all part of your hand. And for most of all, we thank you for those that have brought the gospel to us who might believe in it and have salvation that's secure and for eternity. Bless now as we go to our home. Keep us safe. And for the 2, 3, 4 weeks we'll be apart, may you bless each family as you see fit. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.